Here's what's coming up in the Category5.tv newsroom. Raspberry Pi 4 are having problems with Wi-Fi when connected to high-definition displays. Someone pretended to be mayor and the government gave him a .gov domain. Google has confirmed that a flaw that allowed hackers to take control of Android phone, cameras, microphones, and GPS locations without the owner's permission has been fixed. And a smartwatch advertised as a way to help parents keep track of their children and give them peace of mind can be turned into a frightening surveillance device. Stick around, the full details are coming up later in the show.
This is the Category5.tv newsroom, covering the week's top tech stories with a slight Linux bias.
I am Sasha Rickman, joined this week by Jeff Weston.
All right, some quick honorable mentions this week. Google wants to bring Android as close as possible to the mainline Linux kernel. A new breed of ARM-based smartphones, including the Librium 5 and the Pine phone, are targeting mainline Linux support as a feature, and Google is clearly thinking along the same lines. Switching Android to run on the machine line Linux kernel would be a huge undertaking, one that would inevitably require major technical and political changes to the way that the Linux kernel is currently developed. Instead of each Android device shipping its own device-specific Linux kernel, Google's idea is to upstream as much code as possible. In short, as reporter Ron Amadeo sums up, Google wants to decouple the Linux kernel from its hardware support, and Apple will have to face the law for distributing crappy keyboards. I love it. Apple's been trying to stop a class action lawsuit over faulty MacBook keyboards. Federal Judge Edward Davila has tossed out the attempt. The lawsuit accuses Apple of not only hiding the fragility of MacBook Butterfly keyboards, but also failing to provide an effective fix or full compensation for customers who paid for repairs. The lawsuit covers many Apple laptops with Butterfly keyboards, starting with the original 12-inch MacBook from 2015 and including MacBook Pro models produced in 2016 and later.
Let's get into the top stories we're following this week. Raspberry Pi 4 are having problems with Wi-Fi when connected to high-definition displays. Can't connect your Raspberry Pi 4 to Wi-Fi? Try a lower resolution or a different HDMI cable. Developer Enrico Zini reported, quote, if the Raspberry Pi 4 outputs HDMI at a resolution of 2560 by 1440, the Wi-Fi stops working, end quote. Others have noted that the loss of 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi when using just 1080p resolution, but were able to solve it by switching to the 5 gigahertz band. There are reports that Wi-Fi performance is significantly degraded with monitors connected to HDMI 0. There is less degradation when the monitor is connected to HDMI 1. If you're experiencing this problem, the current recommendation is to use the HDMI port, the lowest resolution possible, do not use Wi-Fi, or wait for the next hardware iteration that will hopefully fix the issue.
Oh, dear. I gotta say, I mean, I've never been a fan of Raspberry Pi Wi-Fi, Right. Plain and simple. So if I was using it as a multimedia PC, I'm going to go with Ethernet anyways, especially now that they've got Gigabit, but to think that now there's this issue that's cropped up. And it's surprising that it didn't come up before now, because Raspberry Pi 4 has been marketed as being like the desktop PC of SBCs. And of course, the home theater PC of SBCs as well. That's how they've marketed it, even though there are more powerful boards out there. But Wi-Fi is kind of critical when you're doing a home theater PC.
It really is. And I mean, this isn't an interesting problem to have where it's based on a specific port that's video based. I mean, right. We're talking HDMI, but suddenly when you're running at a really high resolution, it kicks out your Wi-Fi and only on a certain band.
It feels to me like interference, which is right. Like, isn't this FCC compliant? Like that's how it feels to me.
It should be, but I mean, there's been a number of issues now with the Raspberry Pi 4, and it makes me wonder, like, how did this stuff get missed in the QC aspect of it?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Certainly the USB-C issue comes to mind, where it's not a compliant USB-C port.
Right.
That's a big problem. So you have to have specific cables in order to charge it or to power it.
Is this a newly developing problem? Like, will they be able to fix it with an update? upgrade then, or?
You know, I don't know, Sasha. It seems to me like I say, it sounds like an interference issue, which sounds like something that they would have to do hardware improvements in order to fix that. And I don't know that it's a new issue. It's just that somebody finally made the connection that the Wi-Fi dropping out is with regards to the HDMI output.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As you mentioned, somebody had noticed that if you switch to 5 gigahertz versus 2.4 gigahertz, it seemed to have better connectivity when you're connected to HDMI.
So really, I mean, it's actually a good news story that if all of them were having this problem, at least there's a bit of a workaround.
Sorry. Oh, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you do lose one, you're now missing out on an HDMI port on your Pi.
Yeah, you are.
So,
And there's a fine line. I mean, I think with single board computers too, there are two sides of the user base. There's the side that I am, which is, I know that it's a single board computer. I feel like it's groundbreaking and earth shattering, and the technology has been condensed from the supercomputer into a pocket sized device, and I'm so impressed. And if there's problems, I'm okay with that. And I'm like, I didn't pay a lot for this. And it's like, I'm like on the bleeding edge of what is next. And then there's the other side that's like, I bought this to have two 4K video outputs, and if I connect them, I can't work the Wi-Fi.
Right.
And that's the flip side of it. And I can understand that side of it as well, especially for the non-techie, the non-tinkerer.
Right.
I'm a tinkerer. I want to play around. I don't mind if things don't always work the way they're supposed to, because I love to tinker. And I'm going to be the one who buys the next gen, because I want to see how it progresses.
Well, and you know that they really want excellence, that they're just going to push and make it better for the next gen, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's this fine line also with the development process and the creation of the product, where they're trying to drive down the price to $25, $35.
Right.
And if they're going to do that with two 4K outputs and better Wi-Fi and USB-C, like, they're cutting corners, folks. They're like, you know, they are cutting corners like crazy to make this thing happen.
Yes.
So there's, you know, you gotta put things into perspective. I think
true.
You win a little, you lose a little.
Yeah.
Someone pretended to be a mayor, and the government gave him a .gov domain. Yeah. A security researcher acquired an official .gov domain name to prove a suspected weakness in the system, which could have been used to spread fake emergency alerts or obtain private information about citizens. The researcher posed as the mayor of a small town with a population of less than 6,500 people. All they had to do was set up a fake Google voice number and Gmail address, both completely unaffiliated with the town. After that, they filled out an official authorization form, which basically asks for the same contact information a registrar would require. The documents needed to be printed on the town government's official letterhead, which the researcher obtained by searching for other official documents posted by the town online. According to a town clerk from the actual town, the only inquiry the city received from the GSA came 10 days after the researcher's fake registration was approved. And the GSA only called after the security researcher revealed what they'd done to a cybersecurity reporter, who then inquired about the domain. In the short time they had the domain, which has since been revoked, the researcher was able to sign up for Facebook's law enforcement subpoena request system, which provides law enforcement and government entities with personal user records. Initially, .gov domain names were only available to U.S. federal government institutions. They've since been opened up to state and local governments. At the end of October 2019, a bill was introduced in Congress to improve oversight over government domains by the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency.
Wow.
So they were, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, they did that.
Like, I mean, you would think if there's somebody filling out an application for this, before the approval goes in, you'd start asking questions. But maybe are we just a society that relies so much on the information on the internet that we believe what comes in on an application form?
That is true, yes. And now, to be honest, these .gov domain names, now that this story has come out, would you then not trust? Like, you should not trust them. you know that people can.
I don't know if you could say you can't trust them, because, no. I mean, if I'm going to go to a .gov website, I mean, granted, they're mostly for, like we said, U.S., and a lot of that isn't going to apply necessarily right. for use here in Canada.
Well, we're here in Canada, but remember that most of our viewers are in the United States, even though we have viewers around the world. Yeah,
perspective.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, it
we have to be able to trust
much,
that this is trustworthy.
But I would think, like, you're going to know what you're looking for. I mean, it's not like you're going to randomly search up, like, hey, this is fake.gov.
No, dude. Yeah. We're taught to trust that the lock means that it's secure.
Yes.
The .gov means that it's an official government website.
Right.
So in this instance, so could they not take the actual town website and create a phishing site that now collects your information and gets you to fill in forms that gives the hacker. This was a security researcher, but what if it was a hacker?
Yeah, right. Okay, right? Fair enough.
The good thing is that this is a guy just trying to expose a suspected flaw.
Proving it can be done.
And he did prove it. And I mean, that's good that it ended well, but it could have ended badly. And so people need to maybe dial it back. Like, they opened up the .gov to maybe more, I guess, more complacency by allowing local governments to have it.
Sure.
The scary thing about this, and I mean, maybe it wasn't random, but the fact that one of the first things that this guy did was then get access to the Facebook information.
Why not? Like, continue proving the point.
Well, exactly. But I mean, this is then going to be one of those stories where people are going to go, oh, Facebook. That's, you know, it's like, no. Let's focus on the real issue here. Like, you trusted something that became untrustable.
Yes.
Untrustworthy. Whatever.
This reporter self-reported, right? Like, they
talked to a security expert.
Right.
It wasn't like he went, hey, this is what I've done. Like, he spoke to somebody who then inquired. That's the only reason they found out. If that person didn't inquire, how long could this have gone on?
I would have liked to know. I'm happy not to know, really. It would be scary. But how far could they have gone? Could to the moon?
There's no end, Sasha. There's no end.
And it opens up the question, how many other fake.govs are there out there?
Yeah, so be leery, I suppose.
Yeah, we always have to be careful. Always have to be careful, folks.
We've got to take a quick break. The Crypto Report and more of this week's top tech stories are coming up. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome to the CryptoCon. My name is Robert Koenig, and I'm reporting to you from Florida, USA. I've got an international background, and as you probably can hear, it's a European one. I've been involved in this industry since 2015 and occupied many roles, starting with coding, running teams, supporting ICOs, and like most of us, also losing money through trading tokens. The CryptoCorner will be split in two parts. The first one will be news, so what happened during the last 7 days. And the second part will be about a special subject. This time, we'll be talking about the private key. So let's dive into it. The market cap of the industry has not really changed the last 7 days. There were some ups and downs, but it's hovering around $200 billion US dollars. The Bitcoin market share is around 66%. So those things haven't really changed. What has changed is some interesting news coming from several countries. First one is India. India, for the first time, is committing to do some research on blockchain technologies to establish a national framework for blockchain technologies, which is great news because in the past they have been very negative towards the crypto industry. Germany is starting with a new proposal law that would legalize banks being able to hold cryptocurrencies. In the past, they had to go through third parties, also the holding through third parties. Now they will be hopefully soon allowed to hold them themselves. South Korea has been always very positive towards the crypto industry. But they are now working on a bill that will provide a legal foundation for cryptocurrency. So that's going to be interesting because, as I said, they're leading edge and they have been always very positive in this industry. Other news is Upbit, the exchange went through, was hacked last week, and they stole 342,000 Ether. those are known where they are. So the wallets are known, although not they don't know who the people are behind them. But remains to be seen what will happen with those Ether. The big exchanges, they all said they're not going to trade those Ether into any other cryptocurrency or into fiat. Bitfinex becomes the first major exchange to enable Bitcoin Lightning support, which is interesting because, as you know, Bitcoin Lightning is the second layer application on the Bitcoin platform, which is equivalent to, or they want to have it equivalent to a Visa payment platform in regards to speed and also fees. And then Binance is rolling out Ethereum futures. So previously you could do trade only Bitcoin futures, and now you'll have also the possibility to trade in Ethereum futures. Subject of the week is the private key. The private key is an essential part of a cryptocurrency, and it ultimately defines who the owner of a coin or a token is. Let me give you an example. If you purchase some tokens through an exchange and you leave them on the exchange, then those tokens are not yours. They belong to the exchange. Only once you transfer those tokens over to your wallet, like let's say, for example, Exodus or Trezor or Ledger, then those tokens will be yours. And that's defined through the private key. So always make sure that you are in possession of the private key. And the easiest way to do that is through a wallet like Exodus, as mentioned, Exodus, Trezor, or Ledger. And that's it from me. So see you next week, and thank you for watching.
Thank you, Robert.
And for those of you watching, we do not provide financial advice about cryptocurrency. This is more so just an FYI for you so you know what's happening in the crypto markets.
Google has confirmed that a flaw that allowed hackers to take control of Android phone cameras, microphones, and GPS location without the owner's permission has been fixed. The flaw was identified by security firm Checkmarks, which found, quote, multiple concerning vulnerabilities, end quote, in the Google Camera app that enabled them to spy on its users. The issue, which also affected Samsung, meant that hundreds of millions of smartphone users were at risk. According to the firm, its team found that by, quote, manipulating specific actions and intents, an attacker can control the app to take photos or record videos through a rogue application that has no permission to do so, end quote. Checkmarks also found that certain scenarios enabled hackers to access stored videos and photos or to see GPS metadata embedded in photos that would locate a user. The firm was able to access these vulnerabilities using a mock-up weather app that only required basic storage permissions from an Android user. According to the firm, storage permissions are very broad and give access to the entire SD card. After identifying the flaw, the firm notified Google, which, after researching the report, found that the vulnerabilities were, quote, not specific to the Pixel product line, and that the impact was much greater and extended into the broader Android ecosystem, end quote. The tech giant has since fixed the vulnerabilities and thanked the security firm for identifying the issue. Samsung has also released patches to fix the issue since it was discovered.
That's a scary story.
Yes.
I mean, I am always one, whenever I download an app, I look at all the permissions. And there are times where if I'm looking at two different comparable apps,
yes,
you know, in the Android store will tell me, what permissions does it require? And mm-hmm. I will go with the one that has less access to my phone. But I have noticed with the access to file storage that it is everything. And that's been one of my chief complaints. And I would love to see on a future update that access to storage permissions is broken down to save only, access only, specific areas. Yeah. Like, I would like to see more definition with that. So these kind of things, hopefully, don't happen as often.
Right. So yeah, the part that's scary is the fact that it would look like you're not giving that much permission. It's just for one thing.
Right. But
the one thing is everything.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, with all the apps that people are producing, and I mean, we just went through this with my kids because I found that they've been downloading apps that I have no clue about on their phones.
Right.
And I'm like, what? Why? And what actually alerted us to it is my daughter asked, I mean, she's eight.
Yeah.
She asked me to, you know, to do something on her phone with our dog. And I pop, like, I go to load the screen, like, full-blown, unclothed adult pictures from spyware and stuff that's producing this on her phone. I'm going, come on. What have you downloaded? And she's like, oh, I thought, like, I didn't know. And I'm like, this is my daughter.
Yes.
Because of these apps that she's downloaded that I had no clue. So I mean, we've fixed everything. But I'm thinking, come on. Like, we have to be more aware of what we download. And there's so much stuff within the app stores that just want access to your phone. It's like...
Yeah. I have found that week after week, reading stories like this, I download a whole lot less.
I don't like, change my device. Apps.
Yeah. I know the ones I like and I trust. I don't need to be entertained by my phone, so I don't download entertaining apps.
For those of you who are watching this on your phone, ignore everything that she's saying.
True. But it's scary, right? Because you see, you know, different apps are popping up in the news and they're doing, and they could seem so benign, but they're doing such harm.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess the best thing to do is really just stay on top of.
Yeah.
I mean, at least do what you're doing. Read through what permissions, right? At least do that. And then also hope, like, for example, this has been patched since it was, the vulnerability was released, right? So.
Right.
You just kind of have to hope for the good in it all.
Yep.
Okay. A smartwatch advertised as a way to help parents keep track of their children and give them peace of mind can be turned into a frightening surveillance device. Researchers at the AV Test Institute have uncovered gaping privacy and security holes in the SMA-Watch-M2 smartwatch. The security lapses are so severe that the researchers were able to piece together a snapshot of the life and daily habits of a randomly selected 10-year-old girl from Germany.
Oh my.
Among other data, the Chinese-made device exposed the girl's name, age, place of residence, where she spends most of her day, and the routes she takes. The researchers could even access the sound messages that were transmitted to her device. And that's still not all. They were even able to monitor her real-time GPS position. Obviously, the security shortcomings didn't affect just that single device. The team said it could gain access to the location, phone number, photos, and conversations of well over 5,000 children and was quick to note the number of affected users might, in fact, be far higher. The researchers found that in addition to communication with the manufacturer's server being unencrypted, the online interface of the manufacturer's server was completely unsecured, leaving it entirely open to external unauthorized access. Although an authorization token was generated to prevent unauthorized access, the server does not validate it, which essentially means anyone with enough hacking skills should have no problem in accessing user IDs. This allows potential attackers to have the same access that a parent would have. This lapse in security was found to affect users in Germany, Turkey, Poland, Mexico, Belgium, Hong Kong, Spain, the Netherlands, and China.
Jeff, you don't look pleased.
Yeah.
I think as a parent, I mean, isn't it tough to think that, hey, this device that I bought for, and I didn't, but rhetorical, that I buy for my child so that I can kind of keep track of where they are, and if they get lost in a mall, I can find them, and to realize that there has been little to no security consideration, it feels like a violation by the company who manufactures this, in that you are collecting and allowing this data to be accessible, but putting no effort into the actual security and protection. And as a software developer myself, that is my first consideration.
Yeah.
I've had payment processing websites that come to me and they say, well, why is it so expensive? And I say, because my first consideration is the security of the data of your customers. And that has to be the way it is.
Yes.
You know, oh my goodness, there's so many comments I could make with this. And it, as a parent, this makes me feel ill. Like, yes. I mean, I would love to have, you know, fun tech stuff for my kids. And I mean, oddly enough, for Cyber Monday and Black Friday, we were looking at getting smartwatches for our kids, yeah. ones that provided these kind of capabilities. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't pull the trigger because I didn't recognize the brands. Mm-hmm. They weren't reputable sources. They were good deals.
Yeah.
But they weren't reputable yeah. names. And I'm going, can you trust this?
Right.
And I mean, I hear stories like this and I'm like, you know what? It's time to go off the grid.
Like, right. Well, see, that's the thing. This is a really good idea. It's a really good concept. I mean, in my line of work, it would be really good for people with dementia or, you know, or children. It's really good to monitor the safety of people who are vulnerable. Mm. However, these people are vulnerable and it's really bad to exploit that. I mean, either with malicious intent or just complacency, right? I don't. Like when an idea is good like this, it needs to be followed up with the security that, you know, Robbie provides.
Now this brings up a notification alert question within my head. Like I'm listening to this, I'm going and I'm thinking, okay, Robbie, as a security guy, maybe you can weigh in on this. If you have a company that quite frankly doesn't care, right. they've been exposed for this issue and they don't care. For them, it's about pumping out a device that is going to generate money for them. And if it fails, whatever, they'll just open it up under a new name and do it again. As a parent who goes, this is a great option, but they may not be watching for these kind of alerts.
Yeah.
How, as a parent, do you catch the vulnerabilities with a device mm-hmm. like this if the company decides they're not going to alert you? Like,
yeah.
Does the industry have an alert system where all this stuff gets pushed out that a parent can go, I may not understand it, but I know that this alert says that product I gotta
right.
deal with.
I understand what you're saying. Like, you know, like when there's a tainted produce at the grocery store right. and there's a huge yeah. recall.
I heard a recall today and it's like the product yeah. that was recalled expired yesterday. So anyone who bought it has already eaten it or thrown it away anyways.
Right. But so it's like, right.
What good is that?
From a security standpoint for tech stuff,
right.
where parents can sign up for general alerts yeah. for this kind of stuff?
You know, I don't know of one, but I'm sure there is. And just backing up real quick, I don't want to take the assumption that the people who manufacture the device don't care.
No.
I know it's a hypothetical, but I just want to put that out there that sometimes devices are put out, and a lot of times with these Chinese manufactured products, it's like it's a manufactured thing that gets picked up by a third party, and that third party thinks, hey, this is a great idea, let's bring it to market, and it all happens quickly, and it all happens without really the security guy evaluating it, evaluating the security implications. And certainly this is a big one, especially as we look at right. things like COPPA and the protection of children and the monitoring of children. And now being able to be exploited so easily, I don't know what to say. I mean, it's bad practice all around, but we're feeding into it with the purchasing decisions that we make. And I think you made a good decision, Jeff, to say, yeah. I'm just not going to buy that. But then what do you do if you want those kind of functionalities? And maybe it's, okay, well, sticking with brands that you recognize and sticking with brands that have child-safe policies, perhaps. There must be some. I know, like, ESET has parental controls that you can install on their phone.
Yep.
If your kids have a mobile device that's smart compatible, has internet connectivity, you can trace it using geolocation. And it's obviously, I mean, they're a security company. It's very well encrypted, and you are the only person who has access to that data. So, you know, is that what we have to do? Mm-hmm. It's yeah. not a cheap solution.
No, it's not. And quite frankly, it comes back to a lot of times, you pay for what you
yes.
or you get what you pay for.
Yes.
And I mean, if you're, you know, for us, we didn't pull the pin on these smartwatches for the kids
yeah.
because, hey, it was a great price, but I can't trust the name. If yeah. I'm going to get a smartwatch for my kids, I'm going to pay the $200-$300 for something from, mm-hmm. you know, Samsung or an Apple, because I know that they're going to stand behind their security mm-hmm. if something goes awry.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tricky time of year, too, because everybody really does want to get the newest and greatest. And
So maybe this is a bit of a maybe this is it. Maybe this is the PSA to the parents out there who have purchased these cheap devices from China. That and just using this as the example, it's like, be mindful. Okay, this has happened. This is happening. You need to be protecting your kids.
Crazy.
Big thanks to Roy W. Nash and our community of viewers for submitting stories to us this week. Thanks for watching the Category5.tv newsroom. Don't forget to like and subscribe for all your tech news with a slight Linux bias. And if you appreciate what we do, become a patron at patreon.com/newsroom. From the Category5.tv newsroom, I'm Sasha Rickman.
And I'm Robbie Ferguson.
And I'm Jeff Weston.